Good morning. Welcome to the Paul Green Comedy Podcast. It is April 16th, 2024. This would be episode 139. This is a podcast by a dreamer for all you dreamers out there. Stand-up comedian and actor Paul Green documenting my journey as I rise to comedic greatness. That got a little intense. I normally don't talk that intensely. So, let's see. What is the update? Yesterday, not a whole heck of a lot went down. I did get to hang out with my mom, which was always awesome. We try to do dinner once a week. And I did get my writing in. If you've been following me, I have set a goal. My goal initially was to write 3 new bits. That goal is adjusting a little bit because I've changed up my writing style and my format, and I'm finding that the format is more of fleshing out a whole bit as opposed to just doing 3 jokes. And I have been sharing my new material, so I'm at least trying to share. Now it's not 3 new jokes, but write a new bit and share it online and see how it sounds coming out of my mouth. So those of you following the podcast, you will get to get a first-hand listen to my new material. All right, so here we go. Here's my new bit that I wrote yesterday. So I went to the public library for the first time in years. I mean, it's been at least since, I don't know, maybe since the internet, probably. And anyway, as I'm walking around, all I could think was, this seems like a pretty big waste of money. I mean, this building is massive, it's clean, it's tidy, it's advanced, and as far as I can tell, it really is just serving as about a $500 million public restroom. So I went there to actually write, and I was there for about 3 hours, and I'm just seeing rows and rows of books. And I can honestly say in that 3 hours, I did not see one book leave the shelves. I mean, maybe it happened. Maybe on the far side, beyond what I could see. But I don't know how the government is keeping these things open. I mean, the governments, they're always strapped for cash. Budgets are always tight. Who is standing up for libraries? Who is in charge of lobbying to keep public libraries afloat in these failing economies? You know, I mean, there's got to be some sort of, I don't even know how it works, like a public meeting, I guess, like a budgeting committee meeting, you know, like next on the agenda. Let's see, we will hear, not this guy again. The committee will now hear George Nerdleman with his proposal on why we should spend another $500,000 of the annual budget to keep open our libraries. I mean, I assume the guy's nerdy. But again, the more I thought about it, I was like, actually, he probably can't be a nerd. This guy has to be the most charismatic salesperson ever. He has to be able to convince cities to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on libraries. He's got to go like, hey, guys, listen. I totally get the libraries are not bringing in a lot of revenue, all right? I mean, we did bump our late charges to 25 cents a day. However, everyone returned their books. Or it might be possible that no one borrowed them in the first place. But I don't know what I wrote here. Oh, I said something about, but we got to keep this library open because every once in a while, a homeless guy needs to use the restroom and then borrow War and Peace. So we're going to need about $500,000 to keep this library running And then I guess the committee just goes with it. Just like, well, we were going to take that $500,000 and provide housing, healthcare, and job placement for our homeless population. But no, we'll just go ahead and give them the library instead. Something like that. All right. Just know you're getting rough drafts. You're literally getting first drafts. The stuff that I literally just put pen to paper. I haven't practiced it. I'm doing that thing where comedians, well, we always apologize for our material. Actually, I think a lot of people do that in a lot of different arenas. It's like we either pre-apologize, like, okay, just so you know, I didn't really work this out. Just, it's new, so don't expect it. I do that a lot in comedy, and I'm actually consciously trying not to. But I still do it a lot. And actually, my buddy, Jim Perry, who runs JP's Comedy, he pointed out that I do that a lot within my set, that I will sort of apologize or call out how my jokes aren't good within my set. And he kind of pointed out that he wasn't necessarily saying don't do that. But he was just kind of pointing out, like, yeah, you know, the audience actually may not be seen in that way. And it's the type of thing to where it's not actually a thing, but because I make it a thing, then it's a thing. Maybe it actually wasn't a bad joke, but then because whatever's going on in my head, I say it's a bad joke, then the audience is like, oh, I guess this is a bad joke. Which is kind of interesting. So if you watch yesterday's podcast, I think on yesterday's podcast, I did a bit that I had written about having to move back home with my dad. And I'm really trying to put myself in a different mindset. And like all things in life, trying to be somebody different or think differently or try to perceive and comprehend a different life or a different lifestyle or breaking out of patterns. You know, there's friction there. And I spent a little bit of time really just looking in my, going into my mind and trying to picture what would it actually look like and feel like if I actually had a Netflix special. What would I be saying? What would I be talking about? How would I be feeling? And is the stuff that I'm writing right now, do I see that actually fitting? And not in some sort of, oh, I'm visualizing. It's like, no, can I actually see it? And as I was thinking about it, so I wrote this whole bit about, having to move back in with my dad and, you know, how that makes me feel unsuccessful and blah, blah, blah. But then when I pictured myself having a Netflix special, I'm going, if I have a Netflix special, everybody in that audience thinks, now it may or may not be true, but they think that I'm successful. They probably think I'm like a $1 million celebrity. I think human beings who aren't in the entertainment industry, anybody that they see on TV, I think they think are millionaires. Whether they are or not is a different story. But I'm just thinking, if I was on a Netflix special and I'm in a huge theater with all of these people who know me because I'm now famous enough to get on Netflix, and then I went up there and I just said, so I just had to move in with my dad, and that makes me feel unsuccessful or like a loser, I think that might be confusing to an audience to be like, what you're saying doesn't line up with what we're seeing. like Dave Chappelle wouldn't say that. I mean, any comedian that is on Netflix, you probably wouldn't picture saying that. You know, Taylor Tomlinson's, what, barely pushing 30 years old? And, I mean, she's already extremely successful, but, I mean, even earlier on in her career, I don't think anybody would have believed her if she said, oh yeah, I had to move back home with my dad, even when she was maybe 23, 24, because she was already achieving so much fame and success. So I'm going, So now I'm in this mindset where not only am I trying to write in this new joke format, which, again, my buddy who's been mentoring me, Andrew, really, really helped me start to allow myself to see what comedy at that level looks like and what it sounds like and what it feels like. And now I'm taking the next step of I'm trying to put myself into what I will look like and feel like and what I will be talking about, not with my current life situation, but what it will look like and feel like when I'm actually in the situation that I want to be in. And that probably doesn't include living at home with my dad. That probably means I've reached a level of success to where I feel like I think I may want my own place again. You know. And by the way, could I go get my own apartment if I wanted to? Yeah, I could. There's a little bit more to it, but you know, it would create more financial hardship than I want to have right now. It's like I have other financial goals. So to me it's a lot more than just like I have my own place. It's like, oh, I've actually gotten my financial situation in a much better place overall. And so then I look at it, I'm like, well, if I'm in that better financial place, then that whole bit that I was writing doesn't work anymore. Or I would have to change it to past tense. But then it doesn't make a whole lot of sense why I'm talking about it. And I'm going, well, would that be what I would want to talk about on that first Netflix special is how I had this period of time where I had to move in with my dad. And I'm going, that's probably not it. So I've really started to try to visualize and understand more clearly what it is that I'm actually going for, what it would look like for me to get there, and what I would look like while I'm already there, and what my sets would look like when I'm already there, and my routines would look like when I'm already there. And I'm now starting to try to write material now that will fit the future me, and instead of writing material that fits the current me. And it is it's harder. I say it's harder in some elements. It's harder, but there's another part that's very it's actually very relieving. Relieving, is that a word? I feel relieved in a lot of ways because I feel like I actually have some direction now, and I have a little bit of structure around where my writing is. And my entire comedy career, that's never been the case. My entire stand-up comedy career, I have always struggled to write. And to be honest, I never developed the writing discipline, which every comedian who's ever been successful will tell you is absolutely necessary to get to great levels of success. Every comedian, every podcast I ever heard was, oh yeah, that guy who made it, writing material all the time, every day, hours and hours and hours, every day. Matter of fact, Jimmy Dore, is that the British guy? Kind of the snarky one-liner comedian. Is it Jimmy Dore? It's funny, I can picture him and I can see him and I can hear his voice, but for some reason, Jimmy Carr? Might be Jimmy Carr. So anyway, this little TikTok 30, 45 second clip of his popped up. And he goes, a lot of comedians, because he has that voice, a lot of comedians will say how jealous they are of what I have. But no comedian is jealous of what I had to do to get what I have. He goes, they may see me on the stage with the fame and the Netflix specials, but what they're not jealous of is me sitting down and writing jokes for 10 hours a day. And that's true. I have never written comedy 10 hours a day. Not even close. I'm just trying to get one bit a day right now. So I think there is some real truth to that of, you know, I've talked a lot on this podcast about what my dream is, what I'm going for, and now more and more, I'm really trying to get clear with what it's going to take, what it's going to look like, what sacrifices I need to make, and what work needs to go into this, and one thing that has become very clear to me is most of what I have been doing in terms of stand-up material either needs to go or be rewritten. Yesterday, another thing that happened was my buddy who's been mentoring me, he and I actually pulled up my one-hour comedy special that I did in Tucson last year and just started to go through it joke by joke. And there were a lot of jokes in there that get good laughs and that are going well. And he was just, nope, that's got to go. That's got to go. Nope, 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 nope. And what's kind of interesting is now I see it and I go, oh yeah, even though that joke works, even though that joke gets laughs, even though that joke is clever, even though I have been doing it and it's always worked, that is also part of the sacrifice, is being willing to let go of things that work, things that do work, things that are funny, and letting go of those to allow room for something even better that has even greater capacity to achieve a bigger goal. And, you know, it's not easy to do that. And that's one of the things that, you know, my buddy who's been mentoring me tells me. He just goes, yeah, a lot of comics aren't willing to do that. They get a set that works, and it may work really well, but there's a ceiling on it. And in order to get past to that next level requires writing differently or letting go of what's working and adapting another style or another format that is going to be more global or to be more specific with a brand, which is not fun. It's not easy to hear that, but it's true. I remember Brian Regan. I don't remember what context it was. Some podcast, or maybe it was somebody who asked Brian Regan and they're quoting Brian Regan. So who knows if this is what Brian Regan actually said. But the quote was, and again, I don't remember how I came across it, was something like, you know, Brian Regan was asked, you know, how did you become such a successful comedian? And he said, I learned the difference between good jokes and great jokes, and then I only told great jokes. But I'll tell you, you know, you watch a Brian Regan special, you watch I Walked on the Moon, and it is 1 hour of really great jokes, and there is not one single dip in it. I watched the 1 hour Paul Green comedy special from back in November, and there's a lot of good jokes and a lot of dips and a lot of, well, that's there, that's kind of there, oh, well, that's almost there, and oh well, and like, oh, okay, that was pretty good. And the audience is laughing because they want to. It's not like it's unfunny. I'm not up there. I am entertaining. I do say things that are funny, but again, it is breaching into a new class of comedic consistency and standard. And I'm actually really excited. If I don't seem excited, it's because I'm also just sort of feel like I'm at the foot of another mountain that I'm just looking up at, and I just see how much work is ahead of me to get up that mountain. But I do actually feel, more so than any time in my comedic career, that I do now have at least like a path has sort of made itself visible up that mountain. Whereas, it's pretty intimidating just to look at a mountain and it looks like there's 1,000 trail paths and I have no idea where I'm going or whichever. So I just feel like now it's like, like a light just kind of went, oh, just like this is it. You got to write like this. You got to stay within these lanes. Follow this format. And if you can do that consistently enough and stick to it, then at least you are walking up the path of the mountain in one direction, whereas I feel like I've just been kind of like spending a lot of energy figurating and going back and forth and up and down and trying here and then coming back down or whatever. Now it's kind of like, all right, learn how to write like within that format. Learn how to sound like what every great headlining professional famous stand-up comedian sounds like. Learn what a John Mulaney, a Dave Chappelle, a Kevin Hart, a Neil Brennan, a Brian Regan, a Jim Gaffigan, Eliza Schlesinger, Sarah Silverman, Tig Notaro, Amy Schumer, Wanda Sykes, Jerry Seinfeld, Bill Burr, did I say his name already? I mean, when they do stand-up, what does it sound like? What does it feel like? And how can I write to a level and a standard and perform to a level and a standard to where, when I do an hour of comedy, it feels like it belongs there? Because I can tell you right now what I'm doing, it does not. And that's not me trying to be all self-deprecating. Oh, I suck. It's like, no, I don't suck. I'm pretty good at this. And I've done a lot of great things, and I've made a lot of people laugh as a stand-up comedian. And what I'm looking at now is, how can I make millions more laugh? This brings up an interesting thing. I know I'm kind of getting near the end of time, but there's this concept in art or music, where people will accuse an artist of selling out. Usually happens in music, when maybe a musician goes a little more mainstream. Maybe they were a little more niche, and then they write like a very poppy, catchy song that catches wildfire, and then all of a sudden everybody knows who they are. I'm thinking of like Death Cab for Cutie. I don't know if any of you guys know that band name. Death Cab for Cutie was this indie rock band, very creative, very emo rock. I think they were from the Washington area too, if I remember correctly. And I remember discovering them like early 2000s. And they had this album, I don't remember the name of it, but the songs on there were so unique and so emo and so creative. And he was just, Gibbard, I think his name was Ben Gibbard. was just so creative and his songs were so interesting. And then, like 5 or 6 years later, he comes out with this song called When Soul Meets Body. I want to be where soul meets body. And it was a lot more catchy, and it had a nice rock beat, and it got like major airplay. And it was my least favorite song of theirs. And I remember friends of mine all of a sudden hearing this song be like, oh yeah, this guy's great. I love Death Cab for Cutie. And I kind of had that, whatever, this isn't his real, this is just pop stuff. This, you don't know him like I know him. You know what I mean? And of course, you know, he would get accused of selling out. I view that a lot differently now. Because I look at it as what is the purpose of art if not to elicit an emotional response from other human beings? And it's interesting to me that the greater capacity an artist has to influence more people, that somehow makes them less and less of an artist, which would mean that for some reason we as human beings think that the fewer people who are influenced by your art, the less popular you are, the more artistic you are. Like, whoa, you are artistic because only 3 people showed up to your gig at the coffee shop and heard you sing your latest little song about your breakup, and you made a couple bucks in a water pitcher that was your tip jar that said tips. That's an artist. And it's like, oh, Taylor Swift, she's such a sellout. She only inspires millions and millions and millions of people, tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions of people. She only influences that many people with her art. Oh, what a sellout. Now I get there's more, you know, she's sexy and she's young and, you know, I get all of that. But I'll tell you right now, if it's between me being all niche and emo and being able to influence 10 people who really get me, who will show up and put $2 in a tip jar to hear me do comedy, or me being able to become so skilled in my craft that 18,000 people will buy a ticket to go see me at the Suns Arena, like Nate Bargatze last night or 2 nights ago, I think I'll sell out. So that's my thought on that, everybody. Let's all sell out. And I should clarify, I don't mean sell out as in sell your soul. I mean having enough integrity for the art, but also presenting the art in a manner that allows you to still have your integrity and speak your voice, but also to influence as many people as possible. And I look at it as the more people who are laughing at my jokes, that's the more people who are having a bad day, or the less people who are having a bad day, the less people who, you know, maybe go out and harm themselves or harm somebody else. Or, you know, the more people who I'm able to help get through a crappy life situation, a breakup, a death, a diagnosis, a financial hardship, a job loss. You know, and I'm not trying to act like I'm some altruistic Buddha of the people. You know, I have my vain ambitions and my selfishness, you know, as well. And but I'm just not so concerned with being so artistic, so
niche with my comedy that I'm so true to the art that almost nobody knows who I am and almost nobody comes to see me. But the people who come to see me, they really get it. They really get what I'm going for.
Like, no, I'm totally fine writing a more cheesy, lighthearted joke that will help a million people laugh than writing some dark, sinister, deep joke that, influences a few. Just like Taylor Swift went, hey, you want to know what? Maybe I'll just write a song about shaking it off. All right, everybody. That's enough pontificating for episode 139 of the Paul Green Comedy Podcast, April 16th, 2024. I hope all of you are doing well and you are finding joy in your journey. And if you are looking up at the mountain like I am, that you are excited and ambitious and ready to surge forward. So I love you all so much, and I will talk to you tomorrow.